We're in for a good treat tonight. How many people have been inspired in this room by maybe a film you saw in Hollywood, like Top Gun or Iron Eagle or something like that, right? Absolutely. I actually wanted to be a construction worker until I found out you have to get dirty. And also, I got ruined when my parents showed me this movie called Top Gun in the early 80s. So here I am. So it's because of those movies that influences younger people and older folks to maybe chase something they've always wanted to do. So tonight we're very fortunate to have a few pilots that have flown in movies and did want to make an announcement. We had Steve Hinton coming. Steve Hinton, in case you haven't noticed, the Connie isn't here yet. He's actually working on the Connie to get it here for us still. So he isn't going to be here tonight, but we still have a great lineup, so hang with us. First and foremost, I want to introduce our first panelist. He is the Vice President of Safe Advocacy and Safety, and that is Sean Elliott. Our second panelist is actually one of two. Not usually we get to say that, but our next panelist is Kevin LaRosa, Sr. And our final panelist, and I said one of two, it's because he goes by a few different names. Kevin LaRosa, the second, K2. Answers to Kevin. That's a nice warm welcome for Kevin LaRosa, the second. All right, so I got you all here. So it's a question I always like to ask because I think nobody has the same answer. And in this room is probably the same. What first got you motivated? What first lit your candle to want to be involved in aviation? We'll open it up for, you can chime in how you like. We're just hangar flying here.
All right, so I grew up in an aviation family. My dad was a World War II naval aviator. As a kid, we had a T hangar just a few miles from our house with a 67 Beechcraft Debonair, and sold it on my 16th birthday. Flew model airplanes as a 14-year-old, went to the Nats and competed in control line stunt, and it's in the blood. It's like everybody here, right? When you get bit, it doesn't ever go away.
Yeah, the same with me. My dad was in the military, and I grew up in that atmosphere and always wanted to fly. And when I was old enough, started taking flying lessons at 16 or 17, and it just history from there. I just loved it.
Yeah. This guy is what inspired me to be in aviation. I grew up in an aviation family, third generation pilot, and got the bug at a young age. I think there's videos of you holding me in your Mustang or T6, so I was destined. There was nothing else I was going to do. I wanted to be just like this guy.
So I'm going to start, Kevin Sr., with a question for you.
Sure.
At what point did you enter movie flying? How did that come about?
You've all probably heard this before, but I got into the movie business totally by accident. Being in the right place at the right time, I happened to have when I first got married, I convinced my wife that we had to own an airplane. That took a lot of work, but we got an airplane. And I had this old Navy on. And I was out at the airport working on it one day, and this guy walked up to me and said, hey, is this your airplane? Yeah. He said, well, we'd like to use it in a movie. And of course I needed the money, and I said, okay, that sounds good, and what do you got to do? He said, well, we're going to fly it over this little mountain and blow it up, and you're not going to really blow up, but we're going to make it look like you crashed. And I thought, okay. And then he said, well, can I fly it? And I said, no, I can't do that. I just bought it. It's my baby. It's a piece of junk, but I love it, and no, nobody can fly it. So he thought about it for a minute, and then he said, well, I'll tell you what, how about you fly it for us? I thought, all right, I can do that. What do I have to do? And he said, well, we're going to set up a camera on a mountaintop, and we want you to fly right over the top of this camera and then drop down, and we're going to set off an explosion to make it look like you crashed. And it was the first shows of the Incredible Hulk series with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno and stuff. I had no idea, never saw the show, but anyway, I could do that. Flew over, went down, they set off an explosion, and all of a sudden I was this movie pilot. And I thought, yeah, this is great. I made good money and it was a lot of fun. And I ended up getting a Screen Actors Guild card. I had to, in order to fly on camera, you have to be a member of the Screen Actors Guild. I had no idea what that was or what it meant, but it turned out to be where my career went from there, because I flew on that show. That led to another place where I was working as a pilot flying helicopters, and all of a sudden these TV shows started coming in, and I don't know if a lot of you will remember The Fall Guy, The A-Team, $6 Million Man, all of these shows. And I ended up starting to fly on those because I had a SAG card. I was rated in airplanes and helicopters at the time, and my career just took off from there. I was very, very fortunate.
You left out a little one called Airwolf.
Well, yeah. If you want to get into that, the company that I was working for was doing all these TV shows, and I was a helicopter pilot for the LA City Fire Department at the time, and I was working part-time at this company, and the stunt coordinator from that show was a guy named David Jones, who was doing the Magnum PI series in Hawaii. And when that ended, he came to this company where I was working called Jetcopters, and he brought all these TV shows. But he and Don Belisario, who was the promoter and the guy who came up with Magnum PI, among other things, had this vision of this helicopter show, and that helicopter was going to be Airwolf. There was a helicopter show that came on prior to that, some of you may remember, called Blue Thunder. Anybody remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Blue Thunder was an old Aerospatiale Gazelle that they modified with plywood and windows. It was a real piece of junk, if you will. But it started the show. Well, they came up with Airwolf. And Airwolf, as you may know, was a beautiful Bell 222. It was one of the first ones made. And the designers got together and they made up all these great fiberglass attachments to hook to it and really made it a really sweetheart, great looking machine. And here I was in this company with a multi-engine helicopter rating and a SAG card, and next thing I knew I was flying on Airwolf. So I either flew the Airwolf helicopter or I ended up flying one of the bad guy helicopters, the little 500s, all the dogfighting and the shoot 'em ups and stuff that we used to do with that. And that was a tremendous highlight in my life. I didn't want to tell anybody I'd have done it for free, but they had to pay me. But we had a great time, worked on all those shows, worked with Jan Michael Vincent, and a true great man was Ernie Borgnine. And the show would have gone on and on. It went on for four seasons, and we just had a ball. We were working on everything, but of course, as many of you know, Jan kind of went off the deep edge and got involved in bad stuff. And it came to a point where CBS said, "We don't want him back. We're going to end the show." Well, we were all devastated because we wanted it to go on. But anyway, it ended, and it was a tremendous memory in my life, a very great history.
Just want to call out, I'm an 80s kid, and when I found out you flew Airwolf, everybody backstage made sure that we knew we had an end time tonight, because I could just keep talking about flying Airwolf with you here for probably 3 days. So
there's a funny stories about Airwolf. I mean, I could go on and put you all to sleep here, but Kevin was the only baby child who ever flew in the Airwolf helicopter. Because I had it, and during the off seasons and between the shows, I used to take it to various local air shows around California to kind of promote the show. So my wife and I would load that thing up and we'd fly off, and he'd sit on my wife's lap in the left seat and we'd go to these various air shows. And Airwolf at the time, it was the biggest draw. I mean, when I went to like Watsonville air show every year after a couple of years, Airwolf became the major draw to that air show. People would line up there and wait for me to arrive. I mean, I thought I was God. But we'd get there, and I'd land, and I'd do a little routine in front of everybody, and they'd land me. And the funny thing is, they had to take me and take us in the back, because it was on wheels, I could taxi away, and they'd put it in a hangar. If you all remember, in the back of Airwolf was all this high-tech gadgetry that Ernie Borgnine used to run, all his touch screens, the bullet launchers, whatever he had back there. Well, none of that was really there. The thing was gutted. It was empty inside. So when we took it to the air shows, we put a black curtain up back here. And of course, when I'd land there, everybody, when they'd pull it out, they'd all want to look back there. And we'd just to tell them, well, you can't see what's back there. That's it's all secret stuff. I mean, it would have to kill you. So what was really back there was a baby stroller and a crib and a bunch of other crap. And they didn't want that kind of stuff coming out in the public's eye, so they put me in a hangar and we unloaded everything. And then they dragged me out on the flight line, and it was a fun deal. It was a great day. The only other thing I can think of that I just realized was funny, I had no N number on Airwolf. I mean, Airwolf was Airwolf. It was the only one of a kind. And I remember I was doing my, at the end of the air shows out there, I would do the closing act. I'd go out and I'd take this thing and I'd buzz around and I'd do ag turns and fly backwards and do all the things that helicopters can do, but no one had ever done it in the front of the public before. So I would do this routine and it was a lot of fun. And I remember I landed at the end of the show, and this guy came out of the crowd with a suit and tie and his clipboard, and he walked right up to the door, and he caught me coming out, and he said, "Can I see your aerobatic waiver?" And I said, "I don't have an aerobatic waiver." And he said, "Well, I just saw you do aerobatics." And I said, "No, those weren't aerobatics. Those were ag turns and stuff that guys do in helicopters all the time." Well, he was pretty nice, and he let me go. But then he walked around and he came back to me and he said, "Where's your N number?" And I said, "There's no N number. This is Airwolf. It doesn't have an N number." And again, he was so great, he walked away, and that was the end of that. So that's it. Airwolf was great. When the show was over, we brought it back to the company. They stripped it all off, all the fiberglass stuff that we added on. And the thing flew really well, by the way, with all that stuff on there. But we put it back in total civilian paint and everything else. And I think it was bought by somebody in China. And the last I'd heard it crashed and it was destroyed. I don't know why. But anyway, there you go. Airwolf.
That's awesome. Again, I could talk to you all night about that. So, so transitioning from a new cutting-edge helicopter, the great thing about aviation and movies and things like that, you're able to set the tone for different time periods. And Sean, you got to fly sort of recreating the past instead of going into the future on a film. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. So, first and foremost, caveat, I'm not anywhere near the experience level of these guys right here. They've got fantastic stories. I'm just thrilled to hear them and be part of this tonight. But I did get the privilege of being able to fly in the movie Public Enemies in 2008. With EA's 1929 Ford Trimotor. And we were recreating several scenes from the whole John Dillinger story of what happened to the outlaw John Dillinger and some of the aviation components that were part of that story, including transporting him back from Tucson and also the law enforcement, the law enforcement Texas officials that were flown up to deal with him. So this was supposed to be an American Airlines Ford Trimotor that was flown into Chicago with Dillinger in the back. And of course, Johnny Depp played John Dillinger. And I'm just one of the two pilots, right? So I'm thinking, okay, this will be fun. We'll go fly and shoot some scenes. I've done plenty of formation flying and air to air. This is gonna be really enjoyable. And like Kevin was just talking about, one of the first things is the technical folks called us weeks in ahead and said, okay, first thing we're going to do is we're going to repaint the airplane. We're going to completely make it a different paint scheme with black trim, and we're going to lose all the markings of Eastern Air Transport. And oh, by the way, your N number is going away, so you need to work with your FISDO and get that changed or corrected. I thought, wow, you can delete an N number. I don't know how to do that. Sure enough, there's an FAR in Part 91 that allows you to remove an N number and fly for the purpose of filming. So I didn't know that, but nonetheless, there is. And we worked with our FISDO and got a letter of authorization from the FISDO to be able to go ahead and do that. And that was pretty cool. So then they came and they shot the whole airplane with a mixture of latex paint and ammonia. And that was water resistant if it got rained on, so the colors would stay. But yet, when they were done filming, to remove all that paint and return it right back to its original very nice paint finish, they used a mixture of water and ammonia and was able to strip all that paint off. It was pretty fantastic how it worked and worked like a charm. So show up the first day and they had planned to shoot. Basically, we were available to shoot all day, 24-hour window, right? I'm thinking, well, we'll be done with this in a couple of hours. Our first scene was to be shot over at what then was the original Basler North hangar here at Whitman Field on the north side. And the first thing they did is sent us to Makeup. Folks, I'm just the pilot. Why do you need me to go to makeup? Okay, we'll go to makeup. So off we go, and they fit us for a 1930s airline uniform. That's cool, right? I'm thinking, this is pretty neat. Time to go get your haircut, fellas. What? Haircut? My hair's short. What do I need my haircut for? No, we go to get a haircut. So they had a whole back section of the old Whitman terminal set up just for all the costume work and the makeup and the haircutting. And they actually had beauticians in there, and they gave us a 1930s haircut with the wave and the hair and all of that. I'm thinking, my God, I've never been through anything like this in my life, and it's only the first hour. So we then go back, and the first scene was a flying scene. And they had rigged the airplane up. At first, they had put all this equipment on, as far as the onboard cameras, too far back. So I looked at it, and I asked the weights, and I said, I'm a little concerned. Let's take a look at the center of gravity. Did some math. That's not going to work, guys. We're going to have, because it was outside the CG. So we reconfigured all the equipment. We got it into a place that would work for the airplane CG. And then we went out, and it was a terrible day. It was raining. It was marginal VFR, if not IFR. It was barely a 1,000-foot ceiling, 3 to 4 miles visibility with rain and mist. And all they wanted to do was go and launch out and do a couple of close patterns. And Craig, the pilot, was flying a Eurocopter with a real high-tech gimbal on the front. And he did a great briefing, super professional guy. We talked through the plan and the brief. And he did tell me, he said, look, as we're coming down final, just focus on flying the airplane. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about where I'm at. Your lead, I will fly on you. Just focus on what you need to do, which was really good advice. And I thought, hey, dude, I've flown formation. I'm cool. This will be okay. We come around on downwind, and there's a helicopter. I can see it off to the side. At one point, it's in front of us and kind of sideways at one point, and then back behind us. And okay, he's doing his thing. And we basically turn base and then turn final. And all of a sudden, the helicopter shoots right out in front and turns around and starts flying backwards. I'm doing 80 miles an hour indicated in a Ford Trimotor from 1929, and there's a turbine helicopter literally two airplane lengths ahead of me going backwards. I went back to focusing on the runway and figuring out I better land this airplane well, because I'm not looking at him anymore. It was an incredible experience, and the things that you do, it's all very safety oriented. The professionals are very professional. And it's just a cool experience. There's nothing quite like it for a pilot to get the chance to do something like that. And we did fly Johnny Depp at one point. He asked if there was going to be an in-flight movie, and I said, not tonight.
Well, we actually have a clip of the film. You'll recognize some of the background because it's shot at Whitman and some at Pioneer Airport.
That's correct. That was the second scene.
Yeah, exactly. So if we can go ahead and cue that up, we can watch about a minute and a half here.
Where's that plane? Is there a screen?
Well, that's always where they see.
Where's the audience see?
Oh, they can see.
So the scene where they're getting him out of the airplane, that's all over at our Pioneer Airport, correct?
No, that scene was actually at Basler.
Oh, it was Basler.
And they had lined up the ramp at Basler with those old 30s and 20s vehicles, including motorcycles. And those were supposed to be Texas Rangers, by the way. I forgot the term. But it was really something as we pulled up. The first couple of times we shot that, they didn't like the lighting, and then they came up, it was the Miami Vice director that was the director of the movie, And he came up with the idea, let's run some, we have a stack of these actual torches. Let's run the torches as part of the scene, like they're holding them up, and it'll really make it more dramatic. And I thought, oh, okay, we'll do that. And then, of course, we shot scene after scene after scene to get it right. So they kept tugging us back, shutting the engine down, tugging us back, reloading the airplane, starting the engines, taxiing up, shutting down with these things burning, you know. And finally, they kept saying cut, and let's take another take. And then they finally got to their last set of torches. I thought, man, this better work because we're out of torches. And it worked. It came out really great.
That's awesome. And what's fun is parts of that movie, the effects of that movie are still felt on our town. If you drive down Main Street Oshkosh, there are parts of the town that were remodeled or restored to look like an old town, and it stayed that way. You know, like I think they did the bank and a few other places. They were pretty cool. So, yeah, that's just fantastic. fun piece of history.
It looked great. It was really fun.
It was fun, yeah, too.
So, flying for what I would call TV or movie isn't necessarily the only way you can, fly being filmed. You flew for some commercial ads as well.
Yeah, I've done roughly 300 and 80, 90 motion picture feature films and commercials in my career, and I either flew on them as a camera pilot or the story ship, which is the one you see in like they did, or I was the director and whatever. But the various roles that we play, and Kevin will talk about it a little more, is as an aerial coordinator, it's my job when a director and somebody comes to us with a script and says, hey, Kevin, we're going to make this movie. Here's a script. We'd like you to read it and tell us what you think. So I'll go through there, and I would pick out anything that has to do with aviation, and I'd figure out from there as a coordinator what equipment I might need, whether it's airplanes, helicopters, what camera equipment we might need, where we might do this. And then I go back to them with an idea, and if they like it, we move forward. From there, we'll generate budgets and things like that, and then we'll decide as the coordinator, I'll pick the right pilots to do the various jobs. I mean, I want the best pilots I can fly for me, depending on what aircraft we're flying and what kind of stunt we're gonna do. So I'm not always the guy on camera doing the stunts. I may be behind camera directing them over the radio and putting together the movie. We take these movies very serious nowadays, always. We spend, like I think with Kevin on Top Gun Maverick, they spend over a year in preparation. A lot of these features we'll spend the same amount of time, which involves getting the locations and the right people to, like I said, to fly for us. But then there's so many more things to bring in, the safety aspect. Is the right aircraft available? Are they safe to fly? We have to deal with the FAA to ensure that the airplanes are safe and the pilots meet the qualifications. There are pilot qualifications. In all cases, they have to be commercially rated pilots. They have to be rated in the airplane, current, qualified in everything we do. And we'll let Kevin talk about that, about his experiences with Top Gun. But all the films that we did all take that kind of course, how we have to work.
And so I'm going to refer to you as K2 so we can keep, is that all right to keep everybody?
That's what happens on set. I mean, that's how we got that on set. I used to work for my dad growing up, driving fuel trucks and cleaning helicopters on set and whatever. It was ground support, and I was a ground coordinator. So the guy with an air-to-ground radio relaying to him instructions from the director or anything he would need. And we quickly learned by having two Kevin LaRosas on set that there was mass confusion of who should answer radio calls. So it just became K1 and K2, and it stuck. I know my call sign could change. It happens when you mess up bad enough, so it hasn't changed yet, but I know it's imminent. It happens, so it stuck.
At what point in that career working with your dad did you decide, you know, I think I want to fly for the film as well?
I knew very young, honestly.
K1.
Yeah, exactly. It
wasn't an option.
I had a one-track mind. There was one thing I wanted to do since I was a little boy. It wasn't be a fighter pilot. It wasn't fly airlines. I wanted to be a camera pilot. I wanted to fly a camera and fly for film. So I grew up with that one-track mind. You know, you see kids we've all done it, flying little airplanes around, making airplane noises. I did it in a way where my eyes were the camera because I was watching him fly. He gave me really good advice, which I took. I was probably around 17. I had my initial licensing. And he said, "Bud, if you ever want to do what I do, you're going to have to leave the business." Because here I was going out on movie sets. I could remember being out on Mr. and Mrs. Smith and all these cool movies, working with him, but not really the pilot in command yet. And he said, "No one will trust you. You're a junior, you're my son, and you can't just be my son and have that name. So you gotta go out in the industry, do a lot of cool jobs." And I did great jobs in the aviation industry. I loved them all. I flew traffic watch Cessnas, I flew medical helicopters and news helicopters and private jets. And I don't know if you remember, but part of the advice you gave me was you need to go out there, make your own mistakes, build your time, learn from as many different pilots and co-pilots, things you like, things you don't like, and one day you'll know when you're ready. And for me, that was about 26 or 27. I had about 5,000 hours split between helicopters, jets, and airplanes, and that's when I knew I was ready to come back. So that's kind of how I evolved. But as I did all those jobs, to answer your question, I was unwavered. I knew exactly that I wanted to do this one thing, and I would somehow get back there one day to do it.
So what was the first film that you got to work as an aerial coordinator on?
It was probably one of the TV shows that I got to do. I do SEAL Team and SWAT, so I've been aerial coordinator for those shows for a long time. And we're always doing silly stuff, landing on cars or trains. And then a handful of movies here and there. I mean, but Top Gun Maverick was a little bit different. And I think all of us would agree that movie is a bit of a mammoth as far as an aviation movie is concerned. And how rare, how cool is it that an aviation movie, you know, sold 1.5 billion? You know, even the general public loved that movie. So, you know, we always kind of look at that as the white elephant in the room with motion picture aviation. I'm not sure there'll be anything that'll ever be that big. And I was extremely lucky. I'm pretty young, and I was, you know, even younger by the time I had that movie. So I think I was 33 when I was awarded aerial coordinator for Top Gun Maverick. Super just lucky and in the right place at the right time. But also a little bit like my dad said, I was working on a movie called Jack Reacher with Tom Cruise. And this is 2014. We were walking back to base camp, and he knew I was already doing jet photography. I was flying an old Lear 25B, which was really fun, but older camera systems. And he said, "Kev, one day we're going to make Top Gun 2. We know it was going to be called Maverick then. And he said, "But when we do it, it's all got to be real, and we got to have better technology. It doesn't exist today." And I remember telling my dad about it, like, "Man, I'm going to have to do something. You know, I'm going to have to build something." And talked to him about his T-28 and where he got his ideas and how he put that thing together. And I came up with an L-39. An L-39 is a pretty neat jet. They're easily brought into the U.S. We can get some parts for them. They're quick enough. And I pushed that thing together with a gimbal called a shot over, which is a six-axis, latest and greatest tech. Put that on the front of the jet. I partnered with the Patriot Jet team, the owner of that, Randy Howell. So we turned two of his spare airplanes into what I trademarked as the Cinejet, and we made the airplane. I didn't even know if I was going to get the movie, so that was kind of a Hail Mary of just, I'll build it and hopefully they come. And I remember getting a call one Sunday from the executive producer, Tommy Harper, and he said, "Kev, you want to work on the movie? We want you to fly your camera jet you built. Would you be available?" And I said, "Well, played it cool." It's like, "Yeah, thank God. I should be available for that.
See if I can fit it in."
I'm pretty sure I woke up every neighbor in like a 2-square-mile radius when I hung that phone call up. So that was pretty special. So sometimes, you know, we throw Hail Marys and we think of these wild ideas, and sometimes they work.
Wow. So as we're talking about Top Gun Maverick, is there a scene in that movie to you that was the most challenging to accomplish?
Yeah, you know, I had a counterpart. As I was the civilian aerial coordinator, I had a team of about 60 people that worked for me, and then we had a naval aerial coordinator. His name was Brian Ferguson, call sign Ferg. Still great friends of my dad and I. He's just an incredible human being and patriot. And he was in charge of the Navy side, and we both had this amount, this huge amount of responsibility, one for safety and FAA compliance, and the Navy has a full-time job, so making sure we didn't hinder that. Everything progressed in that movie naturally. And what Ferg and I always say is it got more difficult as we got going, and that has to do with the way the energy was built for you all, for the audience, right? So every flight sequence got a little faster, a little lower, a little crazier, until we got to the final sequence of the movie, which is when they're in the F-18s and they're going to attack that rogue target. For those of you that don't know, that was in the Pacific Northwest. That was in the Cascade Mountain Range. I know it looks like the Swiss Alps or something way, way, way in the middle of nowhere, but that's actually in the United States. And when you fly in the wintertime in there, it is gorgeous, crazy, scary. There's glaciers and volcanoes and huge vertical developments and giant valleys, but it was epic and gorgeous. And our director, Joseph Kaczynski, that's what he wanted. He just wanted to find the coolest terrain that we can build this battle into. So to answer your question, the most difficult part for us in the movie was filming the third act. We were in very unforgiving terrain. We were in very unforgiving weather. I flew the L-39 and the Phenom 300, which was the other jet that I got to fly in the movie, as well as the helicopter platform. In fact, we were so remote and so deep in there that I requested that Paramount hire a safety helicopter that followed me in the camera helicopter in case I had an issue, because we were so deep, they would have never found us, or it would have taken forever by the time if we had an issue. So the third sequence was a lot of work, and it was a lot of fun, and I guarantee you it looked closer in person. It was wild.
Did you have any inkling, did the folks on the set working have any inkling that, I mean, you were creating something special? I mean, Top Gun Maverick is absolutely a special film in the aviation world and in a cinema world altogether. But was there that feeling on set that, wow, this is going to be amazing?
There was. The whole crew, we had this this electricity about it, this buzzing. We knew the first movie was super nostalgic. And we also knew, this is kind of cool. I mean, day one, we were in Navy Air Station Lemoore, and I'd already been on the movie early for testing the Cinejet, and Tom gathered us around. This is like day one of principal photography. And he gave us a little kind of pep talk, if you will, and he said, guys, we're making a sequel to a very historic and iconic movie, and because it's a sequel, we're at a disadvantage. And you're all the best at what you do, and everything we do on this movie, we have to obtain a level of cinematic perfection that's never been done before. So we're going to shoot take after take. We're going to make things as perfect as humanly possible so that the movie is that good. And we were led by Joseph Kaczynski. For those of you who don't know his work, he did Oblivion as well. He's an incredible director and visionary, just a great leader. So every day, I think we knew that. And there was a lot of times we'd have fun. Like we'd come back from a sortie and, you know, some of the production folks would be blasting like the original Top Gun music and make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up and go, man, we're working on Top Gun. Can you believe this? So it was fun, but we knew it was going to be special.
It truly is. I mean, the first Top Gun, I always like to tell people, I was reading somewhere that when that movie came out, you can actually see a stat of a rise in general aviation pilots at the same time the movie Top Gun came out. It definitely had that influence. And I could see it again. It drove an interest in aviation again.
Well, and I think for all of you in the audience, you'd agree, no one really watches Top Gun Maverick once. If you do, you're wrong, we always say. But it's like a movie that we keep seeing over and over again. Most people I know have seen the movie 3, 4, 5 times, and then there's a lot of people that see a lot more than that. That's pretty rare. It's pretty cool.
Also, really cool movie to watch on an airliner going somewhere. It makes you feel a little bit set. Really nerdy thing to do, but I'm guilty. I did that, and it was pretty cool. So,
Kevin, I got to share this because it was meaningful to my life. I was a freshman at Embry-Riddle in 1986 when that movie came out, and watched it on campus for the first time. Top Gun Maverick came out. My son Ryan was a freshman at Embry-Riddle.
Wow!
And we watched it together on campus.
That's wow. Super cool.
Yeah, that's really neat.
That's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So, we're gonna show some clips, but before I do, because it was backstage, you kind of dropped us some clips. So before we roll those, I just want to roll into a second film because we're gonna see some clips from both of these movies. But Devotion is one that's very special. It's actually a theme here at the show this year and at Theater in the Woods for Thursday night. Can you tell us a little bit about filming Devotion?
Absolutely. After Top Gun Maverick, before the movie came out, because we all know it was shelved for COVID, which we all hated, but how great is it that it was at the end because we all got to go to the theater and see it the right way. While it was shelved, we got a call from Black Label Media. It's a big, well-known production company. And they wanted to make a movie that my friend Adam Makos had written this amazing true story book about, and it was the Thomas Hudner and Jesse Brown story of VF-32. Amazing story of heroic actions by naval aviators. And myself and Michael Fitzmaurice, who's the aerial director of photography that usually does all of the camera work, did Top Gun Maverick with me. We got the call and they said, hey, we heard you guys worked on Maverick and the footage is insane. Do you want to do this Navy movie? But this is a little different. This is Corsairs. This is Korean War. And of course, we loved that opportunity. So we got to assemble a team together, and it was really fun because we had to bring 70-year-old aircraft together. We repainted these aircraft to make them, VF-32 aircraft. And I got to work with my friend Glenn Powell again. So if you haven't seen the movie, Hangman is one of the lead actors in this movie. Very different movie, follows the life of two naval aviators and some of the heroic things they did, rising above everything else around them and just working off of that brotherhood and camaraderie that we see in naval aviators and in any service branch, I've learned. So pretty incredible movie. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. We'll be showing it on Friday, I think.
Absolutely. And Thursday night here is we're going to have a talk about the events, the historical events of the mission and of the folks here involved in it. Interesting thing, when you guys were filming the movie, you can't hide anything on social media. So people would be filming picture or, filming you guys out buzzing around or the airport, the Corsairs and stuff taxiing around. And at that same time, we were doing a webinar series here. We still do it. Feature a different airplane every month of our museum. And we said, Corsairs are really topical because they're all over the internet right now with filming and devotion. Let's take a deep dive into our Corsair and we'll talk about its life. And we didn't really know much about it. And it was actually that, the filming and the social media posts that led us to dive into our airplane and find out that the Corsair in our airplane that's sitting on Boeing Plaza right now, the one that's from our museum, was actually a real VF-32 airplane and flew off the Leyte, and Tom Hudner actually flew that airplane.
Wow. That is really cool. That's
yeah.
Neat. Wow.
But it all stemmed from the social posts of the filming of the movie. It's like, oh yeah, we should cue that one up and do the Corsair, and it was all intertwined.
Pretty neat. There's so many times on a movie where we have to adapt and overcome, and anything in aviation, there's a funny story, it's kind of little known, but we, just like everything my dad used to do with ground photography, mounted cameras, that's kind of our secret sauce for motion pictures, right? So for devotion, we wanted to build camera mounts on the Corsair so the audience could take a ride on the Corsair. We built about 6 different stations, wing-mounted, tail-mounted cameras. We had a very special camera that we built on Ericsson Air Museum's 211, which is an FRU-7. It's been modded into a 4. It's rebuilt a couple times. And this camera, if you see the movie, actually hangs under the tail. So it's about 2 feet back and about 2 feet down, and it looks forward. And it makes it look like it's a shot that's almost fake. So you're riding under this Corsair, and you can see how low he is. And that was the idea, was to give you that ground rush perspective. Well, we quickly learned that this camera didn't work, and the director loved this camera, J.D. Dillard. And what would happen is the Corsair would do what the Corsair does great, and it uses oil. It spits oil everywhere. So the second we'd get the airplane out into the range or the river, that whole lens was just completely coated in oil. That means the airplane's working, the engine's doing the right thing, right? But we'd get back and the footage would be all blurry. And he said, guys, we got to overcome this. You got to figure it out. And we had a really cool team of engineers and welders who put this bracket together. And we couldn't really solve it. And one night these two guys, they went to a pet store. And they were walking down the aisles and they found these rubber dog bowls that were basically for camping, like for your dog. And they just thought, man, that looks like the perfect shape of the lens. And they bought one of them and they brought it back and they called us all into the hangar one day. And they said, guys, look at this. We can put this rubber dog bowl on the front of the camera. We'll buy a bicycle handle, like a wire that would be for a brake handle on a bicycle, run it all the way through the fuselage of the Corsair. And we'll take off with it. When the pilot gets into the work environment, we'll have him rip the dog bowl off by pulling this big cable in the cockpit, and it'll give us maybe a few seconds to get a shot. And we built it, and it literally worked. And I remember we'd get out over this beautiful river, and Mike Allard would be in the cockpit, and I'd be right next to him in the L-39, and I'd say, you ready? And he'd say, yeah. And I said, okay, pull the dog bowl. And I'd see him in the Corsair trying to pull this cable, and that thing would rip off, and he would do a couple low-level crazy runs, and we'd get just a couple minutes of footage before the Corsair destroyed that thing. And then the joke is there's probably hikers somewhere in the Snake River up there just wondering what all these dog bowls are doing laying around. I like anything you adapt and overcome, and that stuff's fun. You work with your team, you figure it out.
Well, you were kind enough to, right before we came out, share some clips with us, and let's just take a look at some of the beauty of the work that you do here.
That's the CineJet, so that's the jet we built for Top Gun Maverick. Funny story, before I got the movie, I told you that was just a Hail Mary business idea and I trademarked it. Delta, the same model out here, this A350, reached out to me with an air-to-air shoot. We do a lot of airlines too, and they said, Kev, we heard you had a new jet, and we have a new jet too. We'd like to try using your new jet to film our A350s. So the Top Gun Maverick jet that I built for the movie, its first job ever, was filming that A350 sitting out there. So when you guys fly Delta and you see that footage of that A350, that was the Top Gun Maverick jet just getting a little proof of concept to make sure it worked. So that's the jet on Devotion. That's up in Wenatchee, which was our home base for a lot of Devotion. There's a special tail camera we built on the back end of that thing too, so we can get shots of the Bearcats and the Sky Raiders right up behind the jet. That's a shot of me chasing Steve Hinton Jr., who I wish was here, a dear friend, who's just an incredible warbird pilot, just like his dad. We're getting ready for a sequence. There's a famous part of the movie here where the guys are rolling in to kind of silence some of the AA. That Sky Raider that was there, that's from the Erickson Museum as well, flown by Jim Martinelli, a great guy. And in the movie, when you watch it, you're not going to see that Razorback. That's a W version. That's for sub hunting. So they CG'd the canopy to just be a glass canopy, plexiglass canopy, no Razorback in the movie. More shots of chasing the guys with the L-39. This is the River Run, for those of you that, hope I'm not ruining the movie here, but that's the River Run where Jesse's working on some targets. Those are rockets we built for the movie that the Corsair's flying. That's 211, that's Jesse's airplane. And that's the CineJet getting the shots. Here's some behind the scenes of us working the Snake River. That was me flying Jesse's point of view and having fun. So in everything we do, we actually have the FAA with us here. Everything we got to do is fully FAA approved. We use our movie manuals. That's actually a safety boat with safety divers in case we went into the water. We had to have park rangers and all sorts of folks out there making sure we were protecting the wildlife. There's a whole lot that goes into it. Some behind the scenes from Top Gun Maverick. It's pretty fun. This is very similar to like what you were doing, aerial coordinator, on that commercial we watched. I'm sitting down talking, this is gonna be Walleye, who's a blue angel. It's probably running in slow-mo, so it's probably a little slow here, but Walleye was our secret weapon. Anything below 100 feet on Top Gun Maverick was Walleye, because they're subject matter experts on flying low level. And he came in and did all this stuff. This particular sequence where the F-18 goes over our head is when Mav essentially takes the jet so he can demonstrate that it can be done. So this is Mav's low level run, and you're gonna see us get just rocked by a shockwave here. Those were fun days. We were sweaty and covered in dust, but man, it was fun. This is me flying a Phenom 300 camera jet down the to the USS Theodore Roosevelt. This is Mab's point of view for landing the F-14 on the deck. Sure did. So that was pretty fun. The air boss basically restricted me to 10 feet above the carrier deck. So I got to fly it 11 times. And I remember thinking on that 11th pass, I knew it was our last one because the 10th one was perfect. And we said, you know, we better just do one more just so we're sure it's in the can. Really, we were just having a good time. And I thought, man, if I just, the gear was already down, maybe I should just squeak the throttle back a little bit so I can bolter, maybe log one civilian carrier landing. Probably would have gotten fired.
Or worse.
But that was a pretty cool day. Little known fact, when we showed up for the carrier, first they wouldn't tell me where it was for national security. And I thought that was kind of fun. So they sent us on a vector way out off the coast of Mexico to go find that, they called it Mother, the carrier. And I was talking to control, and eventually they moved me over to Mother on the radio. Now I'm talking to the carrier, and I'm a civilian. So this is a childhood dream. This is pretty fun. And I see the boat, and it's massive on the horizon. I'm like, wow, this is incredible. And I remember on my first approach, that massive boat gets really small. And I started thinking, you know, I'm doing this on a clear day, no pitching deck, there's no weather, the carrier's not going full speed, and it was a handful. It was a lot to do, and it was a lot of fun. There's a phenomenon called the burble. It's basically a bow wave of wind coming over the front of the carrier, settling in the back, and our naval aviators fly that perfectly. And to kind of learn how the Phenom, which has a bigger wing, a private jet, dealt with that, just being ahead of the turbofan engines on the spool was pretty wild. So I had it very easy. But it was an incredible experience, and it really, you know, for the naval aviators out there and listening, thank you for what you do, because that is no joke, and I did it on a very easy day.
Well, first off, again, I could probably sit here and talk Top Gun Maverick and Devotion. Oh, here's another shot here.
This is actually pretty cool. So that's the Cinejet coming. That's me flying with aerial DP David Knoll. That's very early on in Top Gun Maverick. And we hadn't gotten the paperwork to get the Cinejet to Top Gun Navy Falcon. So I'm basing out of I'm trying to remember the name of that base. Do you remember that? It was in the middle of nowhere, and I think they tested the F-117 there, and there was some really cool stuff that was tested there. It'll come to me, but it was in the middle of nowhere. And I'd basically launch, and I would go to a Latin long and usually meet up with the pilot Tambo with Tom Cruise in the back seat. And we would work for about an hour with them down in a canyon, and then we would separate. They'd go back to Fallon, and I'd go back to this kind of remote base, but we were the only people there. It was super fun. And then they finally moved us over to Fallon. But this is cool. This is, if you've seen Devotion, this is Jesse's run, and I wanted you guys to see this. There's no CGI here, so this is just me chasing the Corsair down the river. Wow. And that's Mike Oliver flying his airplane from Ericsson Aircraft Museum. That's 211. You can see the dog bowl cam hanging behind the airplane, so that's literally the camera hanging underneath it there.
Do you have a favorite TV show, movie that's aviation based?
Wait, I'm drawing blanks. I don't know. I liked Jimmy Stewart, the old Jimmy Stewart. What was the one where he flew the
Strategic Air Command?
Strategic Air Command.
Yeah, great.
I
love
that movie.
Me too.
Yeah, that's always been in my mind. And the Flying Tigers with John Wayne was always one of my favorites.
I grew up around, you know, Robert Conrad and Black Sheep Squadron. That one still resonates with me
that
big time.
Good.
Airwolf, I have to say. Hooked on Airwolf as a kid. That was a great one.
Yeah.
I grew up on the first Top Gun, the 1986 movie, so I probably wore that thing out. That's probably my favorite. I mean, I love the new one, too, but that old one's what got me started.
Is it pretty cool for you to have been inspired by the first one and then had such a huge involvement in the second?
I mean, yeah. I mean, when I would taxi in and they'd be playing, the production crew would always play the music, right? It would kind of remind us what we're working on, and it would always give you goosebumps. I remember one day at Fallon, Tom Cruise came out of the PR shop, which is you know, where they get their parachute and everything, and he walked by me, and he looked so good. I mean, he was just Maverick. He was Pete Mitchell in the flesh, and he walked right by me and fist bumped me and walked to his Maverick F-18, and I just was like, oh, my God, I feel like I'm in the movie. Like, it was wild.
That's fantastic. In your opinions, do you have a favorite aviation movie shot or scene that you just think about and you're like, man, that is by far one of the coolest scenes in Hollywood with an airplane?
I can't think of anything right now. I'm sorry.
Those Devotion scenes are certainly right at the top of my list. Between the Corsairs and the Bearcats, I was stunned when I saw that.
Actually, I think in the Maverick, when the guys go over upside down over that ridge, that was cool. Phenomenal that you caught that. That was real. I mean, people, when the movie first came out, I'd seen text, and there's always experts out there in the world came back and said, that's not real. They didn't. That's all CGI. But it was real. Watched him do that. I thought that was incredible. You know the scene I'm talking about where the guys go upside down and down over the other side? That was awesome.
Thanks. Coming from this guy.
Yeah.
We called those the goalposts, and we named all these routes in Washington. We'd go scout. We'd find the coolest terrain we can fly F-18s through, and then we would name them so that we can create our own maps and our routes. And the route my dad's talking about is Purple Route. And that's the pop to the target, and the guys would invert. And it was this beautiful pull with about a 6,000-foot climb up this really steep face, and the guys would invert. And there was two, we called them goalposts. It was just these rock formations, and the 18s would literally go through them and pull inverted. The guys literally did that, and they did that with the actors in the back seat all the time. There's one shot where Rooster inverts and pulls, and of course he's in the back seat of an F. In the movie, we see him in the front seat of an E, we think. And it looks, it was a day where Rooster didn't tighten down his shoulder straps enough. So he literally hit his head on the canopy. And the director loved it so much for the energy, they left that in the movie. But for the pilots, we watched that, you know, he kind of comes out of his seat. And I think he was pretty excited when that happened. But
you should know that when Kevin first started the movie and Tom contacted him and he called me, those kids, those actors in that movie, he wanted them all to know how to fly. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
He put together a whole program. I was a flight instructor at the time and offered to help in this, but every one of those kids the actors took were supposed to take 10 hours of duel with me or Kevin or one of my other instructors in a 172. So they get the feel for flying an airplane, and then from there, you put them in the extra 300.
They went to Chuck Coleman in the extra 300.
Did some aerobatics, and then you took them in the L-39.
We unofficially called it the Tom Cruise Flight Academy.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, no movie pays for this, but, you know, Tom mandated they won't look good on camera if we just stick them in the back of the F-18s. They'll get sick. So our job was to make them pilots, make sure they didn't get sick anymore, and everybody got sick except one actor. She was incredible. And then we needed to build up their G tolerance so they weren't passing out in the back of the seat, unless we wanted them to, like Tarzan in that one sequence. But it was really fun. I mean, and they were great people. They were seriously interested in aviation. They wanted to be immersed.
Yep. And in fact, a couple of them went on to get their pilot license.
Glenn's got his license. Tarzan has his license. Monica's about to start.
Yeah.
And that's why they look so good. And a lot of people don't understand, when you're watching them in the backseat of these F-18s, all production companies would typically just do that in CG, or they'd have a buck, we call it, which is a cockpit on stage in green screen. That wasn't allowed. We had these unwritten rules in Top Gun Maverick from Joe Kaczynski and Tom Cruise. And rule number one, which we always abided by, was it has to be real. They have to be in an airplane. And you imagine we would go through these extensive briefs that usually I would lead in the morning. It's creative, logistics, and then finish with safety. We'd go to the PR shops and get dressed and go fly for 2 hours, come back, debrief, and we'd do it twice a day. We want that pretty light in the morning and then pretty light in the evening. What you don't realize is when you see the actors in the back of these aircraft, they have to become their own director. They have to become their own DP, which means they're telling director of photography, they're telling their pilots that are flying them, the naval aviators, can you turn 10 degrees left so I can make sure the sun ball's over here so that the lighting is hitting the side of my face. They're literally the director and DP. They become their own hair, makeup, and wardrobe. We would put little mirrors in their flight suit. And of course, you can't have FOD in the back of an F-18, so everything has to be secure. So they would say to their pilots, I'm unzipping and pulling my mirror out. And they'd sit there and they would spritz themselves with a little bottle for sweat. And they would fix their mask and their helmet. And they'd shove all that stuff back in their flight suit. And then they would have to tell the pilot flying them, people don't understand this, where they are and what they need to do. And they'd be reading their lines. And it was really fun for the naval aviators because they're sitting in the front and, you know, Monica's saying, you know, break right, hangman, do this. And the naval aviators are, you know, just listening to them being animated in the back seat. We taught them, and Tom taught them, eye lines. Like, when you're watching the movie and Monica's dash two, she's looking right here at dash one, there's nothing there. She just has learned so that when we all watch the movie, it's believable that she's staring at number one, and she's been taught, you don't take your eyes off lead. You're dash two, you're the formation. So there's so many little details, and I'd bore everybody, and it would take forever, but they had to do so much, those actors in the backseat, and they wouldn't have done it as good as they did had my dad not taught them in the 172s or Chuck Coleman in the 300s. It was the fact that they, when they got into the F-18s, they were seasoned and they didn't get sick. They were ready to go.
Yep. That's awesome.
I thought two more scenes, Chris, are worth mentioning too, because I think everybody that sees certain takeoff scenes, it sticks with you and you watch it over and over again. Certainly the scene in the Rocketeer with the GBZ, which I believe Steve Hinton did the flying on.
Yeah.
And also the takeoff scene of Memphis Belle.
Yeah.
With the F-model B-17 in that movie. Just phenomenal scenes.
I love, if you ever saw a movie called Always, there's a scene where the PBY comes down behind guys with a stalled boat It kind of splashes down and scooping up water and takes off and knocks the guys out.
So if you watch the boat, they're trying to start the outboard.
Yeah.
And it's an Evinrude. And I have a good friend of mine that works down at Mercury. And he said, we wanted to put that in a commercial so bad because it wouldn't start.
So question for K2. Did you get to fly in an F-18 at all?
I did. And it wasn't until well after the movie. The Navy got very busy with their full-time job, which they wouldn't always tell us exactly what they were doing. And on, for everyone wondering, we didn't get anything for free. Top Gun Maverick and the Government Affairs and Accountability Office watched everything. So we had to pay for every F-18, all the crew that came with it. We had to pay to turn the carrier because they're all our assets. They're taxpayer assets. They can't be used for a movie. So I wanted to fly in an F-18 so bad throughout the filming of the movie, but all that time was so precious, and we needed that to be used during the film. And it wasn't until about 6 months after that I got a call from Chris Papiano, who runs Top Gun, and I got invited up to go fly in the F-18 as a thank you. I remember flying my Super Decathlon up to Navy Fallon. I thought that was really cool. And I got briefed, and they had a brand new Rhino, or F-18, that they just had gotten at the Top Gun school, and I was going to fly in that one, and of course it broke. But I thought this was really special. The backup airplane to the one I was supposed to fly in was the Mab Jet. So I ended up flying in the F model Mab Jet with the Tom Cruise colors on it. And that, even though it was an older jet, that was way more special for me because I've spent hundreds of hours filming that airplane and I got to ride in it. And then I also got to fly with the U.S. Navy Blue Angels about 6 months after that. And I flew with Chomps in number 4, and that was just something I'll never forget. So yes, got to fly.
One of the questions we got here is, once you're flying, and I think all three of you have probably experienced this for a film, how much of it sort of goes scripted, and how much of it do you have to improvise while you're doing it?
We can't change the writer's vision of the movie that he's written. What we do, we'll come in as the aerial guys and we'll say, you know, what he's asking you to do here is we can't do that, but we'll give you an alternative. What if we do it this way and try to make it look like that? And usually they'll go with that because they'll trust our judgment for safety and the right way. But we don't ad lib anything. Not when you're playing with airplanes and helicopters and low level and backwards and forwards, whatever. It's too risky. Everything we do is fully rehearsed, fully briefed before each flight. So we don't ad-lib. I mean, the actors may ad-lib lines or whatever they want to do, but we pretty much run tight to what we've been rehearsed and practiced to do.
In Top Gun Maverick, there was two sequences in the movie that changed rather quickly, and I always talk about it, most people don't know it, but there's a sequence where Mav not only doesn't get kicked out of the Navy, he's chosen to be the team leader, and he's got to go tell Penny. And that was originally written in a different way. I don't know exactly what it was supposed to be, but I've heard that she was going to be much more upset with him, and there was going to be some drama there. And I remember when, I think it was Ferg, my naval counterpart, when he found out about that, and he's Navy, he said, no way, that's not how this works. We're not going to, Joe, you can't do that. And what we learned is, that, and this is a testament to Navy and Air Force, any family members, any spouses, they're the rock. That's the supporting infrastructure to who we are as pilots when they have to go to war. I'm a civilian. And what was told to him was, Joe, Penny's going to initially be a little shocked, but then she's going to support him. And that's how a true spouse, a service member spouse, would be. Of course, they don't want that. They have the hardest job. They got to wait for the horrible phone call that could come and hopefully doesn't come. That was told to Joe, and Joe thought that was a great idea. So when you watch Maverick, you know, she's shocked, and then eventually when they're on the beach, she gives him that hug. That was pretty cool. And the other thing that was changed in the script, which is really cool, when the final sequence, when they're dodging all those SAMs, that wasn't really supposed to go that way in the script. And we played a video one day in a brief for Joe Kaczynski. In 1991, it was January 19th, there was an F-16 over Iraq that evaded 6 SAM missiles. The guy defended all of them just using flare and chaff. And you can watch the video on YouTube. It's an amazing what he does, but he's out of energy. He's gassed and tired. You can just hear it in his voice, and there's mass confusion. There's orders coming in, he's evading, and there's other aircraft out there that are trying to help him. And we played that video for Joe. So when you watch Top Gun Maverick in that final sequence when they're trying to evade the SAMs, it's kind of modeled after that video in that there's this fog of war and mass confusion, and there's forward controllers giving commands, and there's aircraft all over the place. And it always gives me chills when I watch that sequence of the movie because it seems very realistic and just that kind of all that adrenaline coming together at once. So I'd say I agree with my dad. We stick to the script. We know what we're going to do when we go fly. We definitely take advantage of moments of opportunity, but sometimes we come up with good ideas and share them, and things can change for the best.
And I would add to what Kevin just described too is that at least the little experience I had with Public Enemies, and it was Michael Mann was the director. The flight portions of the filming were very professionally briefed, very well planned, and you planned the flight and you flew the plan, just like we do in general aviation. What then got interesting was the number of takes it took on the ground scenes. The flight scene was pretty straightforward and by the plan. When we got to some of those ground scenes, we started at 10 in the morning. We didn't finish until 3:30 in the morning of the next morning.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It was a long, long day of shooting. And it was primarily for the ground scenes and some of the things they kept changing and redoing. And it was cut, let's take another take, cut, let's take another take. It was, that was an eye opener for me that works that way. I didn't expect that.
One more time, yeah. One more time.
Yeah, exactly.
When we talk about, you know, CGI versus the real flying, what are your thoughts, all three of you, please chime in, about just being able to watch a real object, the real aircraft flying, versus CGIing it in there somewhere. Someone was asking that.
Well, we all want it real, right? I mean, you can tell, we can tell, and I know most people here at Oshkosh can tell when something's fake. It just doesn't, there's something weird about it. It's not moving right, or the control surfaces aren't doing the right thing. And I think that was special with Top Gun Maverick, and they marketed that very well when the movie was gonna be released to the public, is that this was all done in camera. This is real flying. CGI is important. We can't blow up airplanes, and we definitely don't want to die for making pretty pictures of airplanes. So CGI has a place. I think the perfect recipe is we like seeing practical aircraft used in a way that is correct and authentic, and then CGI comes in to enhance it. And Top Gun Maverick did that great, right? So we added missiles, we added smoke in the air, we added, you know, fire explosions when we couldn't crash aircraft, and most importantly, we reskinned aircraft, and that's a technology that's brand new. And it was incredible. I would go out and I would shoot a sortie with F-18s, and about a week later, Ryan Tudhope, the VFX manager, would come over with his laptop and go, "Kev, tell me what you think of this. This is your shot from last week." And it would be an F-14 doing this maneuver. And I would have to stare at this and go, that looks real. I can't, you know, I didn't do that, but I remember being there. And if they can fool us or you guys, then that's really good technology. Obviously, Iran wasn't going to give us any F-14s for Top Gun Maverick. So we reskin stuff in the Dark Star. That is an F-18. It's actually, fun fact, it was Blue Angel number 5. It was a spare jet. It was a Legacy Hornet that Walleye flew. That's Dark Star. It was a Blue Angel jet. And it was reskinned to be the Dark Star. So it has a place, and it can be useful. But, man, it's like nails on a chalkboard for us when we see it done wrong.
How about you, Sean? How do you feel about for to see
the real
totally
stuff, agree. Right? So if you've ever seen the movie, the original Catch-22, which RB-25 at EAA Berlin Express was in that movie, some great flying scenes. But their philosophy back then was they actually wrecked a B-25 and burned it up as part of one of the scenes. I'm so glad that we don't do that anymore. And CGI makes that all possible. So devotion, in my opinion, as an enthusiast, right? Devotion had the perfect balance. The level of in-flight footage that looks so good, combined with the enhancements for CGI, it was seamless, and you couldn't tell virtually what was CGI and what was real, and it just got it right. I think some movies have too much CGI, and that's unfortunate, but these guys nailed it in Devotion, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, there's one shot in my life that I wish was CGI, that probably should have been CGI in Maverick, and a lot of people, you know, still argue this through today, And that's where we completely ripped the roof off a building right next to Ed Harris. That, I wish, would have been CGI, because I probably lost a couple years off my life thinking we were going to take him out. But that was completely by accident. We tested that for 2 days and waited for the proper light and briefed Ed on how cool it was going to be. And you're just going to get hit with a lot of jet wash and dust. And set literally just got blown up around him. And I remember Joe Kaczynski was like, yes, that was great. Can we go again? And I was like, no, there's nothing left. You're not going again. It's destroyed. We're done.
And Harris didn't even flinch.
Just steely-eyed, gristly, everything we would want Ed Harris to be. And, you know, in between takes, he's playing baseball with a PA on set. Like, I love that guy. And, you know, this Blue Angel just went over his head 30 feet above in full burner, and he'd even fall over or flinch. So that's pretty awesome.
So as we're heading toward the end of our evening here, I want to ask you guys one final question from the audience, and that is, what do you like to fly in your downtime, and what is your favorite airplane to fly?
Is that our model airplanes?
Yeah. We could go both.
I've owned many airplanes in my life. I think all the Warbirds, of course, were my favorites. The T-6 I had for 12 years. And then I bought a P-51. I was a partner with a friend of mine, and that's just an honor, an incredible experience to be able to fly one of those things. It's just the best. I've flown the T-28s, B-25s, and now I love flying the helicopter as a camera ship, but I've slowed down to where I think I just want to fly his little decathlon and babysit his kids. That's
Sean, how about yourself?
Yeah, I'm with you. Good answer. Well, I've been very, very blessed in my life. The heavy iron from World War II that I've had the privilege of being able to be PIC, and I continue to be PIC. I'm one of 8 left seat qualified B-29 pilots in the world that is current and qualified in Doc and Fifi.
That's crazy.
And that airplane is so rewarding. It's phenomenal. The challenges that it poses, And the rewards of doing it well and doing it right are definitely fantastic. But I have to say, after 21 years now of flying B-17s, and particularly EA's aluminum overcast, that airplane is like my favorite old sweater. I wear that airplane, and it feels so right. It's sad right now that it's down, but we will get it back in the air at an appropriate point, and that airplane just lives in my heart.
Same here, absolutely. Kevin, K2?
I remember flying around in the back of your Mustang. That's by far my favorite airplane ever, is P-51D. But I was too young, I didn't get to fly it, but it was an honor to get to fly with Dad from the back seat. I think if I had to pick something that I fly currently, I love that L-39. It could use another 4,000 pounds of thrust, but it's light on the controls and it takes good care of me, and we've been through a lot together, so I love that L-39 Cinejet.
Awesome. Well, thank you. You talk about honor. It's been an absolute honor to get to hang out with you all tonight. You guys as well. Thank you for coming. Thanks for supporting Theater in the Woods and EA and Air Venture. It's good to see you guys all out there. And again, thank you guys for coming. It's been a wonderful night. I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow night.